Boyd. Up next on Think, lots of people worry that the Trump administration's views on foreign policy would create big problems for America. We'll talk to an expert who says that hasn't happened. Randall Schweller is editor-in-chief of the journal Security Studies, and he says although the America First Trump doctrine is a radical departure from the way his predecessors approached international affairs, Trump's approach may be just what the country needs, given the new realities of the post-Cold War world. We'll talk about how economic nationalism, import tariffs, and one-to-one deals instead of multilateral agreements might be good for the U.S., even if they are not good for our allies. Our conversation starts after a short break. To see President Trump throw a rally for himself is to see him adored.
My administration is protecting ethanol, all right? That's what you want to hear.
The enthusiasm rallygoers have for the president's promise to make America great again, even when he's not currently running for office, is extraordinary. On the other side of the political spectrum, and rarely present at those rallies, are the Americans who seem to hold this president in extraordinary contempt, convinced that everything he thinks, says, and does is wrong and bad for America. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Randall Schweller is professor of political science and director of the Program for Realist Foreign Policy at Ohio State University. He's also editor-in-chief of the journal Security Studies. He understands why President Trump's realist worldview is jarring. He's the first commander-in-chief in the modern era to so directly pursue an agenda that puts America first every time. But Schweller notes geopolitics have changed a lot since the end of the Cold War, and it now makes sense for the United States to start looking out for number one. Schweller's essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine is called Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. He joins us from the studios of WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Randy, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
So for people who don't know the term, can you define, roughly speaking, what realist foreign policy represents?
Realism is the oldest theory of international relations, and it's rooted in this idea that states should pursue power and security, I wouldn't say in a ruthless way, but in a very self-interested way, a narrow self-interested way, because they live in a system that can be characterized as anarchic, in a sense. What that means is that there is no sovereign arbiter to make and enforce agreements among states. And a simple way to put that is there's no world government. So if you get in trouble, there's no 911 you can call in international relations. You got to rely on your own arrangements that you've made for yourself. Hopefully, you can be somewhat self-sufficient. That's the goal. So it's a dangerous world and in some sense, and you have to look out for number one.
So when you say, you know, you wouldn't go so far as to say ruthless. For example, realist foreign policy doesn't say, well, we could probably absorb a lot of territory that doesn't currently belong to us. It's not about world domination. It's about protecting what exists.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more defensive in nature. I think what a realist would say is that states expand when they can, but not recklessly. So the United States, of course, expanded across its continent. Russia did the same. If you don't get any pushback, then that's fine. Realism would say where there are power vacuums, you know, just like nature abhors a vacuum, international politics abhors a vacuum. So where there are power vacuums, states will fill the vacuum. But you're correct to say that it's not a theory about reckless aggression and imperialism, because it's ultimately, you know, the core realist theory of international relations is balance of power theory, which says that aggressive states, particularly very greedy aggressive states, will provoke a counter coalition so they will be balanced against. So it's kind of like shooting yourself in the foot.
What goes around comes around.
Exactly.
You start this essay by reminding us of some of the really dire predictions issued by lots of experts upon the election of President Trump. Can you remind us of some of the concerns that have been expressed that have thus far failed to come true?
Well, I think the biggest one was that
people were saying that the stock market would crash. We'd have this terrible recession. And, you know, this was a Krugman, Paul Krugman, among many who said that. I remember watching Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, which I even watch, even as a Republican. I have to see what she's saying occasionally, particularly when Trump won. And she had this very glum look on her face because the futures markets were showing that the Dow would be down 600 points. Well, you know, here we are almost two years later, and the Dow is, even though it's been falling lately, it's still at 25,700. And I think when he took over, it was about 16,700. So, you know, there were all kinds of predictions, the end of the world. And on this, I want to say that psychologically, for psychological reasons, we tend to never live in a golden age. You know, we never live in a golden age. We only remember golden ages, or we look forward to them with great anticipation. But we are living in a golden age. You would never know it from the coverage on in the media. And the hysteria, I believe, on the left. Where, you know, the economy is doing great, unemployment is way down, corporate profits are up, consumer confidence is up. So, you know, I think we're doing great, but you'd never know it.
So, as I'm sure you've noticed, there are a lot of people who really just dislike this president on a kind of visceral mm-hmm. level. But mm-hmm. honestly, that's been true of pretty much every president, depending on, you know, which party is in control. People are either really behind their guy or really against the other guy. Some objections are rational. Some objections are emotional. Is there something about Donald Trump specifically that makes people unusually blind to either his strengths or his weaknesses?
That's a great question. I think it's because he has narcissistic tendencies, and even one who supports him, he is, you know, he's a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker. I understand. I've met many people like him. He's very different than a politician. He is the first, like, head of a corporation. He's a CEO. And we've just never seen that before. And he doesn't talk to people like a politician. I'm not saying all CEOs are aggressive or you know, alpha males or whatever, but there's that sense that he's just not gracious, and he's clunky sometimes. What the left loved about Obama was his soaring rhetoric. They love soaring rhetoric. I mean, the media loves soaring rhetoric, and you just don't get that usually from Trump. He wings it. And there's a sense of him, he says what's on his mind. There's nothing filtering his thoughts. So I think he's incredibly transparent. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think he's a president that would be exactly who he is in private as he is in public. And to me, that's a good thing. But to many people, particularly, I would say, like the foreign policy establishment and the media, this is just, you know, this is just, he's a bull in a china shop. He's just nothing like they've ever seen. And so they just can't stand him. And I think they tend to misinterpret everything he says. You know, I'm not saying he walks into it lots of times, but I just don't, like, you know, I was just listening to NPR as before I got in here, and I'm listening to Max Boot excoriate Republicans and people who voted for Trump as they're all racist. You know, it's the Hillary Clinton, they're deplorables. And I just think that is such a mischaracterization of the people who support Trump and Trump himself. I don't think he's at all racist, but I think he's a man of his time. You know, he's not politically correct.
You note that President Trump has continued the Obama-era policy of avoiding large-scale conventional war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But where Obama was criticized by many people for allowing Syria to sort of cross that red line into chemical weapons, President Trump did launch an airstrike mm-hmm. in retaliation for Bashar al-Assad's use of those weapons on civilians. Can we say that Trump's actions will keep Assad from deploying chemical weapons in the future?
No. I think that's going too far. That was a strange, rather uncharacteristic. It's not a very realist response, I will say that. But because realists would say, you know, it was about human rights. Now, having said that, the United States is an enormously powerful country. And so, you know, we can do all kinds of things that other countries can't dream of, like project power. And I think that this was a case where Trump saw these children dying of nerve gas, and it was appalling. And he said, well, if we can go in there and you know, launch an attack and it won't cost us very much, we have the military out there, then let's do it and teach them a lesson. Will he do it again? I don't know. He's a very unpredictable leader, Assad. So I can't say, but I think if he does it again, he'll probably get the same treatment, maybe a little worse the next time.
What has the Trump administration done to push ISIS mostly out of Syria and Iraq?
Well, you know, lots of things, but they let the generals do more up front. You know, they gave them more power to do things on the ground. It's a complicated story. I wouldn't pretend to know all the details of how they did it, but I just think Trump deserves credit for the fact that ISIS has been almost annihilated. You know, they're still around. They're on the internet and things like that. But for the most part, ISIS is gone. And again, I don't hear anyone, you know, there's occasional talk about what a good thing that is, but I don't hear it on places like CNN or MSNBC. And I think most Americans are quite grateful that ISIS is gone. And I'm not going to say that Trump is, you know, entirely responsible for that, but he certainly deserves some credit for that.
Well, I think there, and I'm not an expert in this part of the world, but there are people who would argue that it wasn't like a unilateral U.S. effort to push ISIS out. The U.S. is not on the ground in Syria. There are a lot of other there are a lot of other entities fighting ISIS, and that sounds like the kind of international effort that you're saying maybe isn't a great idea or isn't necessary in a realist political worldview.
Well, I think it's a good outcome, and like I say, the United States is an extremely safe country. I mean, we are extremely secure. Maybe the world's most we are the world's most secure state. The world has never seen a state more secure than we are. So we can do things like get rid of ISIS. That said, I don't think that we should expend enormous amounts of blood and treasure to do so. In fact, in the Middle East, I really would think and I would hope that the U.S. tries to get out of the Middle East. There's just nothing in it for us anymore. And one of the good things Trump has done, like Obama, is avoid large-scale wars in the Middle East. So whereas I'm happy that ISIS is gone, I don't think ISIS was a great threat to the United States. It was a very bad annoyance. But that's about it. So the fact that we could get rid of ISIS and it wouldn't cost us, you know, we didn't need a large-scale invasion to do it, that's very good.
So you know that President Trump has rejected many of the kind of foundational ideals of the liberal international order that has governed geopolitics really since the end of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. What kinds of activities would you say the U.S. has taken on as a responsibility in the past, as obligations, without consideration to how much it would cost us domestically?
Well, the Middle East. I mean, all you have to do is think about what we've done in the Middle East and what has it really gotten us? Very little of anything. But I think this whole idea of that we engage in a social engineering sort of on a global scale with the rest of the world, this highly interventionist foreign policy that was endorsed by both the left and the right, whether it was liberal engagers or neoconservatives on the right, you know, trying to make the world, you know, democratic, promoting democracy, you know, this whole thing in the Middle East that Bush started where we were going to democratize the Middle East, these grandiose plans, somehow, you know, a few guns will knock a few heads and we'll somehow have a democratized Middle East. I would say like our foreign policy has just been mismanaged for two decades, criminally so, by the foreign policy establishment, whether it's, you know, what we did in Bosnia, what we did in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. And you could even go back as far as the Vietnam War, but I'll just, you know, that's going back a ways. But, you know, the foreign policy establishment has done a lot of crazy things that have done nothing to further or advance American national security. In fact, all they've done is make things worse.
My guest is Randall Schweller, professor of political science and director of the program for realist foreign policy at Ohio State University. He's also editor-in-chief of the journal Security Studies. His essay in Foreign Affairs magazine is called Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. Welcome back to The Conversation. In 2 minutes, if you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Randall Schweller, who's professor of political science and director of the program for realist foreign policy at Ohio State University. Recently, he published an essay in Foreign Affairs magazine called Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think at kera.org. Randy, you call President Trump an economic nationalist. What does that mean, and how has he acted on his instincts?
Well, yes, an economic nationalist. So this is, he came into office saying that he wanted to rebalance the United States trade accounts with the rest of the world. And, we ran a $566 billion trade deficit in 2017. And Trump is saying, look, this has got to stop. We're for free trade, but we want it to be fair trade. And so what I say in the article is no more Uncle Sugar. And we see this, with Trump really playing hardball with our allies. So he's renegotiated trade deals with South Korea and then Mexico and Canada, and he's still working on Europe and Japan, but we'll get those done. And all those trade deals happen to have a clause where you can't negotiate with non-market economies, meaning China. You can't have a separate deal or you'll lose access to American markets. So this is all like a grand strategy for Trump, essentially, to sort of put together a coalition after we've renegotiated all these trade deals of our allies against China and really put it to China. So economic nationalism, well, it's about not free trade for the sake of free trade. It's, it says, what is trade is something that has to benefit the American people. And globalization is not something that is necessarily a good thing for the United States. It depends. We're not trading. We don't care if we create a Chinese middle class. What we care about is creating an American, or helping the American middle class. And many Americans feel that, our trade policies have just sent jobs overseas and ruined our manufacturing sector, and that we're always getting taken advantage of. And Trump has been saying that for decades. So
are trade deficits always a zero-sum game? Because I've heard people point out that, for example, American consumers benefit from buying, household products that are imported from other countries and are less expensive to manufacture there than here.
Yeah, no, I mean, trade deficits are a simple metric for, a crude metric. But I don't think they're entirely wrong either. And it is very strange that our friends and allies say that Trump is, he's ruining, he is destroying the liberal trade system. And yet we're the ones running all the deficits. Sure, I mean, trade is good for us in some way. I mean, consumers get cheap goods. I understand that, but but it goes much further. The economic nationalism is not just about trade. It's about the Chinese, for example, forced technology transfers. It's the Chinese, devaluing their currency or not letting American tech companies buy Chinese tech companies while their state enterprises buy up American competitors in high tech. So there's a lot of things going on that are just not fair right now. And the key to this is, and this is very important, is that the United States has enormous bargaining leverage. And this is something Trump is very willing to use. And I found many, every president prior to Trump was just not willing to acknowledge or use American bargaining leverage in a sense that everyone needs access to the American markets. It's what we call asymmetric interdependence. In any relationship, one side will be more dependent than the other. And in every relationship the United States have, they need us more than we need them. So this is why Trump would say, you want to have a trade war? Fine, bring it on. You know, you need us much more than we need you. And so there is no doubt in my mind, anyone will tell you that China's had engaged in a trade war with the United States for a decade. We just don't respond. You know, it's this Uncle Sugar, really Uncle Sucker, is what we've been. And Trump just, you know, he sees the weakness in them. And he's saying, okay, you'll blink before I do. There's going to be some pain, of course, with these tariff wars. We're seeing it. But, you know, in the end, he thinks, you know, we can make better deals.
Setting aside China for just a moment, have our allies prospered at our expense during the era of the liberal international order?
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, a lot of what we've been doing, that's the second dimension, sort of the Trump grand strategy, is what I call, you know, no more free riding. And Trump, he's been saying this all week in his rallies about how states like Saudi Arabia, he said that King Salman wouldn't be around for 2 weeks if we withdrew our military support for his regime. And he made this statement, and I quote, "We make military deals where we protect rich nations and we don't get reimbursed." And I know the foreign policy establishment says this is very petty. This is what we call transactional foreign diplomacy. And, you know, how can we talk to our allies like this? It's so demeaning. But the truth is, even Obama talked about free riding. He was very upset by it. But this is a president that's going to say it out loud. He doesn't care if he's being polite. And the fact is, Japan is a rich country. They spend less than 1% of their GDP on defense. Germany is a rich country. It spends about 1.2% of its GDP on defense. In fact, when they had military exercises in last November, I believe, they were using brooms for guns and cargo vans, you know, just commercial vans for armored vehicles. This is how woefully unprepared they are. So the U.S. spends over 3% of its much larger of its GDP on defense. So, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that what we're doing is what I would say is welfare for the rich.
I totally get that. But doesn't the U.S. also have a vested interest? I mean, we have significant military presences in both Japan and Germany. Are we mm-hmm. sort of paying rent for those bases that we have overseas?
But it's crazy to me because, you see, like, what do we care? What's in our interest to defend Germany? Let's say, who are we defending them from? Let's say it's Russia. You know, I think that's crazy. The Cold War is over. But, you know, there are a lot of people in the media talk about Cold War, you know, and on the left talking about, and on the right even, talking about Cold War 2.0. So they think Russia is our mortal enemy, though we're not at war with them. But, all right, so they want that. Well, Europe is about 20 times more wealthy than Russia. Russia is like a gas station with nuclear weapons. What do we need? You know, what do we need to protect wealthy Europe from this, you know, threat of Russia, whatever you want to call it? It's not a threat, but let's even assume they're correct. What do we need this? Why? It's crazy to me that the dialogue or the narrative is that the rest of the world is doing us a favor by letting us protect them. You know, we don't need it. Japan, what do we care? You know, if we leave, I believe they'll be much more upset and much less secure than America will feel upset and insecure.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have David on the line in Beaumont. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in just because I want to take umbrage with what your guest said at the beginning of the program, that the left has a problem with Donald Trump because he doesn't have soaring rhetoric. It's far, far more serious than the fact that Mr. Trump doesn't speak with soaring rhetoric. The personal human, excuse me for a second, the human qualities that Trump exhibits on a daily basis are what the left has problems with. In a country that's supposed to look out for its weaker citizens espouses to be fair and democratic for all the people who live in its borders. We have someone who is has exhibited or at least participated in racist rhetoric, misogynistic behavior,
such as
bullying behavior. I'm an educator. I've been an educator for almost 30 years. And the personal characteristics that he exhibits on the world stage and as leader of this country are characteristics that we do not allow in any of our school-age children.
All right, David, thank you so much. I really appreciate you calling. Do you want to respond to that, Randy?
I just feel like, you know, he says he engages in racist comments. What in particular did he say that you think is racist?
I think a lot of people have seen the president's responses to pretty significant situations and he has seemed as if he was not particularly concerned about attacks on people, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, that sort of thing.
Oh, I just disagree. I don't see that at all. In fact, I think.
I also think, forgive me, I'm a white person, and typically if a person of color says something is racist, I tend to believe them.
Well, you know, I don't think that that's a reason to believe someone, but, you know, I don't think the color of a person's skin is a determinant of whether they're a truth sayer or not, because I think that people of the same color skin will disagree on what they see and hear. I think what Trump does is, like I say, he's not self-aware of how his remarks can be interpreted. And what we see is a very ungenerous interpretations of what he's saying. And we could just go through every remark. I mean, you have to go through each individual case, and I will show you what I think he is saying, what I'm confident that he's saying, and it's not racist. But this is, you know, if people want to believe he's racist, you know, they've been calling Republicans racist for decades and decades and decades. I just have to disagree with that.
My guest is Randall Schweller. He is professor of political science and director of the Program for Realist Foreign Policy at Ohio State University. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to talk a little bit about trade deals. What was once called NAFTA has been replaced by an agreement now known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. It was negotiated between the U.S. and each other partner separately. What's the advantage to the U.S. pursuing bilateral trade and security deals rather than multinational partnerships?
Or multilateralism. Yeah, as I said earlier, if you see, multilateral deals are designed to place limits on the returns to power, in a sense. That's what, by that, what I mean is that you have, it's much harder for the U.S. to use its bargaining leverage and bargaining power in a multilateral setting. So, you know, as Trump was pointing out when he was renegotiating NAFTA, Mexico is a very different country from Canada. And so it makes a lot more sense to negotiate with them individually than it does collectively.
Some observers have worried, and you address this in the piece, that President Trump is looking to dismantle NATO. First of all, do you think that that's true? Have you seen indications that that is the case?
He wants to. Those are his instincts, but he can't. He has hired people that are more foreign policy establishment types, like Rex Tillerson, and then I think Mike Pompeo and Mattis, and certainly John Bolton. And I don't think these people actually, they're not radical in their views on foreign policy the way Trump is. Trump's instincts are, and I think they are correct, that NATO is obsolete. But he's not going to be able to dismantle NATO, though I will say people that I respect greatly right after the Cold War, back in 1991, said that maybe NATO's days aren't numbered, but its years are. So this is not something that is radical from the perspective of, let's say, realists, very famous realists, Kenneth Waltz, very, very respected realists, said that NATO. You see, the point about alliances is that their greatest enemy of an alliance is success. Once you defeat the enemy, the alliance is supposed to break up. But NATO has not broken up. And, you know, the question is, who is NATO? What is the target of NATO? And some would respond, well, NATO was designed to keep America in, keep Germany down, and keep the Russians out. Maybe it's still doing the same thing. I don't know.
Do you think Americans who have concerns about the president's apparently collegial relations with Vladimir Putin and with Russia are worried about nothing? Should we be concerned that Russia could pose a military or an economic or a geopolitical threat to the United States?
Russia cannot pose an economic or military threat to the United States. And, you know, we have a lot that we can do in concert with the Russians. But our relationship is right now is off the rails. And I think Trump's instincts are correct, that there's, you know, we don't have to love Vladimir Putin to recognize that we have interests in common and that we should try to be on good terms with them, the Russians. And I honestly think Russia has been misunderstood in many ways. I'm not saying that Putin is a perfect leader, but what happened in Ukraine, there are two sides to that story. For example, just to point out the obvious, you know, the rebels who overthrew the Ukrainian government, overthrew a democratically elected government in Yanukovych, and then they outlawed Russian language. So, I mean, imagine that the shoe were on the other foot and this had happened to the United States in its backyard, in its sphere of influence, you know. We might have responded, too.
So a realist says, why wouldn't the Russians go into Ukraine?
Absolutely.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. We have Todd calling from Garland. Hi, Todd.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, comment, however you want to phrase that, is about our lack of strategic foreign policy. How does a democracy that changes hands every 4 to 8 years compete with an entity like China that's able to put a 50-year plan in place and just keep marching to a steady beat of one drum?
Thanks for your call.
I'll take my answer off there.
All right.
Yeah, this has been a concern for, you know, before even the Cold War, but certainly when the Cold War started, everyone was worried that America was at a great disadvantage because, you know, we have elections and the Russians, they can do whatever they want, you know, because they have strong leaders. But it turned out that American government, American democracy is actually far better than an authoritarian system because we have checks and balances and we have greater information and we tend to be smarter because we do have free press and checks and balances and all those kinds of things. That said, I mean, we've done a lot of stupid things. So, you know, I think that's the real story, is that the foreign policy establishment, these people that get on TV and claim to be experts and listen to everything you say, they should be questioned.
All right. Yeah. My guest is Randall Schweller. He is editor-in-chief of Security Studies and has an essay in Foreign Affairs magazine, Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Randall Schweller, professor of political science and director of the Program for Realist Foreign Policy at Ohio State University. He's got an essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine called Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. Randy, Todd's call before the break brought up the difference between the sort of short political leadership cycles in the United States as compared with, you know, decades of single party leadership in places like Russia and China. You say that we should welcome as Americans President Trump's prioritizing of short term deals over long term relationships. Will the short-term gains we're making now that are bothering a lot of our allies and enemies alike persist into the future?
Only time will tell, but I don't think I actually say that. But
forgive me if I put words in your mouth.
No, that's okay. But that's okay. You got the gist is that he makes short-term deals. I think Americans have to start thinking he ran on America first. And some people say he's an authoritarian or semi-democratic. I read this in places even like Foreign Affairs. And I think that the fact that he's actually doing what he ran on, that he's actually carrying through on it, is remarkably democratic, whether you like what he's doing or not. And, part of it is that, you know, putting America first means we're not talking about the long run anymore. We're not talking about making the world democratic and, you know, promoting values of democracy and human rights and long run changing the world and making it more utopian. We're talking about what's in it for us right now, because we live in a more competitive world where we need others less than we used to, because we're not fighting a communist system, you know, a Soviet, global Soviet threat. And we're not, and but they need us less too. You know, they don't need our protection as much as we used to. So we live in a world where, you know, enemies and friends is a very, you know, there are no long-run enemies and long-run friends. There's just American interests, and those are permanent in a sense. And so we have to promote our interests in a narrow, self-interested way, more so than we have in the past. And it also includes more of a short-run, let's get what we can get.
You mentioned that the U.S. is the world's greatest import market, sort of in general. Mm-hmm. Lots of analysts point to the future of places like China and even India surpassing the United States. Should we prepare? Should we build goodwill for a time when the United States doesn't hold sort of unipolar economic primacy?
Yeah, I think the world is becoming more multipolar, but I do see U.S. dominance as far as the eye can see. The Indians, they don't have very good government. There's so much corruption, and much of their growth is limited to a few cities. So they have, you know, enormous inequality across the country. It's a big country. There are more languages in India than there are, you know, different languages than there are in all of Europe. So India does not worry me so much, although they have a very good worker to retiree ratio. And I know that I'm a consultant for the CIA, and they see India as in the sweet spot, so to speak, of growth. But I'm not so worried. China, I would not trade our economy for a second with China's. They have so many problems. If we have a pension problem, think of what China has, because they had that one child policy, and they're going to have so many retirees to workers. I don't know how they're going to deal with that. They have corruption. They have pollution problems. They have all kinds of problems. So I think the United States will be number one for a long time to come, but we will see a more competitive world.
The president has been an avid booster of U.S. manufacturing, and I'm interested in the net effect on jobs of bringing manufacturing capacity back. It seems to me that U.S. producers would be inclined to staff factories with robots and other kinds of technologies rather than humans. And yet I think a lot of people picture, great, we'll have those good factory jobs. And you know, we picture lines of people in aprons making really good salaries. That I don't know that that's realistic in the 21st century.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm, you know, the second industrial revolution of robotics. I don't know how that's going to play out. Some think it's very dire, but I think that we'll find things for humans to do in conjunction with robots that we just haven't dreamed of yet, but it will happen. Can we become a manufacturing country again? If that's the question, the way we were, no, but we can protect our sort of vital strategic industries, aluminum, steel. You don't want to be dependent. There again, realists would say never. You want to be self-sufficient in vital, strategic sort of industries, manufacturing. And I think there can be, you know, there have been manufacturing jobs created in the United States. We can still do that. But will we be like we were in the 1950s? No.
Why are steel and aluminum tariffs, in your view, especially important, and specifically important, I should say, for U.S. national security?
Well, I like I was just saying, I think that there are certain strategic industries you don't want to be dependent on others for steel and aluminum. Now, many think that this was just an excuse for, you know, Trump to, you know, he got this verdict, you know, this from his administration, and they think it's an excuse just to raise tariffs on steel and aluminum. And I don't know, you know, maybe it is just domestic politics. If you want to take a, you know, you can be cynical and say, well, this is all just about winning Pennsylvania and Northern Ohio. And, you know, and it's all politics. And you know, maybe there is some of that. But I do feel that, you know, it is consistent with a realist theme of, you know, you want to be self-sufficient in strategic industries.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us on via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Tom in Collin County. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Chris. Great show. And just shows that NPR is very fair, and we'll have on somebody like this that's a Pollyannic supporter of Trump and Putin and steel tariffs and all the things that are so wrong right now. So I'd really appreciate it. Since he doesn't really have much work knowledge and has been mostly stuck in books, how are we handling the employment problem today with these immigration laws? Because they're not working, and they're causing many industries to have difficulties in their normal course of business, and that is Trump's fault. It's not anybody else's but his.
Hang on a second. When you talk about employment, you're talking about the low unemployment rate, and businesses are having a hard time finding people to hire. Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, exactly. The construction industry here in North Texas has seen 10,000 less homes being built.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Randy. What about that?
I'm not sure what the question is.
Well, you talk about the reduced numbers of undocumented immigration. Should we be concerned that with fewer people coming into the country from elsewhere, that businesses are struggling to find enough people to put in the jobs that they want to grow their businesses?
No,
I'm going to rephrase the question, assuming that's what it was.
I'm certainly not worried about that. I think there are plenty of Americans to do these jobs, and that's not what I'm claiming. That I'm against immigration. I'm for legal immigration. I mean, who's against that? I don't think Trump is against that. We're just for, you know, against illegal immigration. Who could be? It's almost to me. I just don't even understand how you can support illegal immigration. It makes no sense to me. We have borders. Again, as a realist would say, you know, the most important job that a country can do, the most important thing that the government should do is protect its borders. I mean, that's just simple 101, you know, international relations. If you can't protect your borders, you're just a government in name, not in practice. Now, the other things the caller said, just one thing I would like to say, he says, I'm stuck in books. I think that that's kind of the problem with our foreign policy leaders is that they, you know, maybe they should read more and write more and study more and talk less, and we might be in better shape. You know, we do policy predictions. Go read what we said about the Iraq War and see who was right. The scholars who wrote the New York Times op-ed prior to the Iraq War, or the foreign policy establishment that was all in.
What's the relationship between foreign policy realism and American exceptionalism?
That's a good question. What's the relationship between realism and foreign policy exceptionalism? Well, the relationship is that realists think that all states are pretty much seek the same thing, that they're enduring truths about international politics. And America is exceptional to some extent, that, you know, to a large extent, we are the only hegemon. We are the only state in the history of the world, because of our blessed geography, to achieve hegemony in our hemisphere. No other state. There have been many states that have sought hegemony in their hemisphere, but they've never achieved it. So we are exceptional in that sense. But, you know, and we are a great country. I love America. I love our values. But I think, you know, we live in a world of international politics where, you know, you have things that are enduring about it, and that you can't escape international politics. You have to sort of understand it and live within its constraints. That said, I mean, this also gets to sort of America's manifest destiny versus mission. And I would say the fact that America is exceptional does not mean that we have to go around the world trying to, in a sort of manifest destiny way, try to make the world safe for America or like America. We're better off being the shining city on the hill and letting others emulate what they like about us.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Are you saying that we don't have any particular moral obligation to the rest of the world simply by virtue of our strength and power and prosperity? We should just do what's good for us.
Well, because we're so safe, because we're so strong, we have the luxury, which no other states have, of promoting our values in the world. And I'm not saying that we can't do that, that we should never do that. But I think, and here is where I so disagree with the, you know, people who have been running our foreign policy, whether it's Colin Powell or Madeleine Albright or whoever. I think that America needs to be more humble and recognize that one size does not fit all, and that inside every foreigner is not an American dying to get out. And, you know, and you have to see, look at our foreign policy over the past two decades, three decades, and ask yourself, if we were a firm, we would have gone bankrupt. You know, we just happen to be super powerful. We can do all kinds of foolish things, and we still, you know, we can lap the field in a sense. But it is not the wisdom of our foreign policy. So maybe we should just, you know, try to be less ambitious in what we think we can accomplish in the world. Because first of all, we cannot change the world generally. I mean, you know, it's difficult. And second, we don't want people believing that we control the world when we don't.
So this may not be a perfect example, but I like to remain friendly with my neighbors, not necessarily because I think they will run and help me if my house catches on fire, but I think we're all aware that's sort of the way it works. Is the U.S. jeopardizing relationships with allies who might have been called to help us in a variety of capacities by choosing not to step in and help them when we're strong and they're weak?
Such as, who do you have in mind?
I'm trying to think, you know, if you're talking about choosing to sort of divest ourselves from some, you know, allied relationships and not really worry about how we get along with even our allies in Europe or places like, you know, Canada and Mexico. Does it matter?
Well, I would say it obviously doesn't matter how much Americans have done for our European allies if all we ask from them is that we renegotiate trade deals and are treated more fairly and that they spend a whole whopping 2% of their GDP on defense. If that is enough to sever our relationship after 75 years of essentially, you know, saving them from a Soviet attack, then you can see how worthless it is to try to win others' favor or be in their good graces. I mean, my gosh, we're just asking for fairness. And if they say, well, we don't think it's fair, well, that's fine, but it's what we perceive to be fair, you know. So if we don't, I trust that we are not, you know, doing anything that's asking for things that are just too greedy. I'm sure that, you know, they are, like, for example, Canada, they were protecting their dairy industry in a very Byzantine and anachronistic way, and now they're not.
Randall Schweller is professor of political science and director of the program for realist foreign policy at Ohio State University, and he's editor-in-chief of the journal Security Studies. His essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine is called Three Cheers for Trump's Foreign Policy. Randy, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thank you, Chris.
We want to thank all of you for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at KERATHINK and use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast. If you'd like to find out about upcoming shows, go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.